Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, with a new partnership. Find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Ezra David Romero, filling in for Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll hear from a crew of Central Valley hotshots, the highly trained California firefighters who take on the most dangerous tasks. They're in Puerto Rico to help with recovery from Hurricane Maria. Plus, we'll learn all about a new book celebrating the glory days of the roadside motel that once lined parts of the valley. While many of them have checked out for good, the book Motel California remembers them in their prime. And later in the program, we'll learn more about the Fresno Philharmonic's new conductor, Ray Hotoda, and about her first concert this weekend with that title. But first, over the last month, we've brought you stories about how online short-term rental sites are changing the communities on the route to Yosemite National Park. We've reported about how the influx in vacation rentals is creating a shortage of places for locals to rent for the long term, and in some cases, creating homelessness. And now, as I report, the growing lack of long-term rentals is causing a hiring issue in Yosemite. It takes an army of people to keep Yosemite National Park's facilities tidy from the constant barrage of tourists. 4 million people are expected to visit this year, with a majority in the summer months. This spring, Ron Bourne, with the maintenance division of the park, was on track to hire a full custodial staff.
Of 30 seasonal custodial workers that we had positions with funds, we were only able to fill those 17 of those positions.
He couldn't fill 10% of his workforce of about 300 people when they chose not to work in the park because of the lack of rentals in the area. One of his employees was recently in the process of trying to rent a house in Mariposa County.
They were negotiating, and then the owner came back and said, "No, I'm sorry, you know, I can't rent to you because I can make my mortgage as an Airbnb. So I'm sorry I cannot do a long-term rental agreement."
Bourne himself commutes from Merced to Yosemite because he wasn't able to find a long-term rental close to the park. That gap in hires left the park vulnerable and a bit dirty this summer. Yosemite Public Information Officer Scott Gedeman is showing me one of the busiest restrooms in the park. Thousands use the facilities daily at Lower Yosemite Falls.
It's dirty. There's some litter I see. Somebody I noticed left some gloves and a toilet paper. We would like the public to see a cleaner restroom than they're seeing now.
It's a big restroom, and even one tour bus full of visitors can make it look like no one's cleaned it in days.
In the middle of the summer, we'll get 50 to 60 tour buses a day. With the staffing shortages that we experienced this summer, there were times when I walked into it personally, and it would just be a lot messier than it is now.
Gedeman says hires can't find places to live because so many long-term rentals are being converted to vacation rentals like Airbnb and VRBO in the communities that lead into the park. In Madera County, there are more than 300 short-term rentals and 600-plus in Mariposa County. Both counties have established guidelines for short-term rentals, but aren't discouraging them because they stand to make a lot of money from taxes they bring in. Madera County has collected over $3 million so far this year.
Thank you for calling Sierra Foothill Homes. This is Patty. May I help you?
Patty Radonovich-Souza is a property manager in the Gold Rush town of Mariposa. She gets calls daily from people looking for long-term rentals.
And we've been turning people away since the first of the year consistently. We have had one or two homes come up, and surprisingly, they were very large, expensive homes, and they surprisingly rented within a month.
She says it's almost easier to buy a home in the mountains near Yosemite than it is to rent a spot. She says there's a long waiting list for rentals here, and she wishes she could rent to more park employees.
You also have then an opportunity as a business person to weed through your applicants a little bit more. You can get good applicants, which means long-term applicants. The other thing is Park Service people are one of our best customers.
Still, it's not just low-paid short-term employees that are saying it's hard to find rentals in the area. Kathleen Morse is the Division Chief for Strategic Planning with Yosemite National Park.
Our permanent workforce is making good money, but they're not making enough to afford some of the better homes in the area. It hits everybody fairly equally. It's not like having the permanent job and the permanent salary gives you that much of a leg up.
The park employs around 450 long-term employees and around 600 short-term employees, but only has about 400 beds for them. At the height of the summer, the park needs about 200 more. Moore says many who take jobs end up having to live further and further away in places like Merced. She says hires then have to decide if the long commute and cost to travel into the park are worth it.
After a while, it takes a toll on a person. So we'll have people for a while, and then they'll fall off, they'll disappear, and they'll quit. And then we have to go through the hiring process again. So you lose efficiencies.
In response, Morse joined a new task force in Mariposa County to come up with ways to increase housing opportunities here.
I don't think that they feel like they have their arms around the problem. So this committee is designed to examine the different opportunities out there. Is there a way the county can be more effective in gathering resources and directing them towards this problem?
Morse anticipates the problem will get worse next year, and that means she and her team are going to have to come up with a solution pretty quick. But at this point, she admits she doesn't have one. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero in Yosemite National Park. You're listening to Valley Edition. At first glance, there doesn't seem to be much in common between a California wildfire and the massive hurricane that devastated Puerto Rico. Fire destroys vast acreages of land in flames, and hurricanes do their damage with wind and water. But look a little closer at the aftermath, and the two disasters have more in common than one might expect. Now a crew of Central Valley hotshots, the highly trained California firefighters who take on the most dangerous tasks, are in Puerto Rico to help. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with hotshot firefighter Kurt Waldenese before they left for the island on Friday. They talk about what exactly a wildfire and hurricane have in common and how they think they can help.
What's similar between responding to a forest fire in California and a hurricane on an island in the Caribbean?
Well, from what I understand, we're going to clear vegetation out of roads, which in a fire situation, that's kind of our expertise, is clearing the vegetation and the fuels. So I believe we're going to clear the vegetation out of the road, which is corresponding with the same type of work, you know, clearing roads and whatnot in a devastated area.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, we're going to use our chainsaws. We're highly skilled in chainsaw operation, so I believe that's the reason we've been picked to do this. Cutting, and I don't know if they're going to use equipment to move the logs or if we're going to have to do it with just manpower.
So in the years you've learned all these chainsaw skills, what goes into it? What is it about being a hotshot and working on the fires here in California that give you the skills to help clear those roads?
Well, I mean, we're a highly physically fit group of people that can work, you know, long, strenuous 12 to 16 hour days. And I think that doing such a thing in a time, you know, we'll be able to clear the roads in a timely manner with people that can have the endurance to keep working for a very long period of time.
When you've done fires, I know you said you've been a firefighter now for 6 years, right?
Yeah.
When you've done them, how significant is the road blockage you have to deal with?
Well, usually on a fire, you know, usually we get trees that burn and fall across the road, and occasionally we have to clear that. But a lot of times, like, you get into this, you know, Central and Southern California brush component, and we'll have a fire that's burning in a, you know, literally 6 to 10 feet of super thick brush. And we basically got to make a road along the edge of the fire to be able to put in a hand line to stop the fire. So I think it's going to be pretty similar to that with, you know, the blowdown and the devastation there.
So for you, it's not even just like kicking the log off the road there. Like, you deal with a lot of really complicated
exactly
vegetation.
Get jackstraw down.
What's jackstraw?
That's like a lot of logs that are like put together in a, you know, they're all bound together, one, you know, from falling down, and it's, you have to understand how to take relief cuts and manage the binds of the wood without getting anyone injured.
And I can imagine that there's a lot of that going on. Like if the hurricane comes through and blows all these trees down, it would make sense. It would be all tangled up like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to fall in an even, orderly manner whatsoever. It's going to be a real mess, you know.
What's the number one tip that you've learned from some of the older guys or someone who, as yourself, just getting started on the hotshot crew, what's the number one tip for wielding that chainsaw?
Just pay attention to where your tip is on the chainsaw at all times, and you know, definitely area control and safety for you and the people around you is the number one thing, I would say.
Don't get hit with the pointy end.
Yeah, exactly that, and you got to watch where your logs are rolling and make sure that nobody, you know, downhill of it or anywhere that somebody might be injured.
Yeah, that's going to be especially important in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is not flat.
No, that's from the pictures I've seen, it looks like some pretty steep terrain, and that's definitely going to be an issue with rolling material and whatnot, especially things that have already fallen, you know, you don't really know.
Do you think the mountain environments up here where you have to deal with these really remote areas, is that going to help?
Yeah, I mean, we're used to working in steep terrain. That's kind of where hot shots get sent, is the worst areas of the fire and the steepest terrain. So I think that that'll be a big help with us dealing in, if we have to deal with steep terrain and the jungle or heavily vegetated areas.
Are you from here?
I'm from Mariposa. Which... But,
so you're from the Central Valley?
Yes, I've lived here for the last 20 years or so.
And how old are you?
36.
So have you ever been in a hurricane?
Or
in a hurricane damage zone?
No, I never have. I've never dealt with any severe weather like that. So that'll be an eye-opener for sure.
I guess in one regard, it's a bit safer because the hurricane's not coming back, whereas a hot shot, you jump in right on the front line.
Yeah, that's true. We always have to keep a good escape route and everything. We won't have to worry about that unless, of course, there's more weather that comes while we're there. We were talking about that this morning, the possibility of, seems like a pretty active hurricane season.
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Yeah, for sure.
Ever been to Puerto Rico?
No, I've never been anywhere off the mainland U.S. I worked in Alaska for a couple seasons, but yeah, so.
So how are you feeling? What are you thinking about the potential that you could be there days or weeks or your supervisor says up to a month?
I think it's just going to be like any other fire assignment, you know. You're going to miss the family and being home and all that, but once we get through it, you know, there's a certain amount of time and then we'll come home. Just do our job while we're there.
Yeah, and it's certainly something a lot of people out there could use your help and expertise.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're going to be very helpful. You know, being a 20-person crew, we'll have a lot of hands to help, and the skills with the chainsaw, I think, will come in very handy.
You said 20 is going? Is that how many is going?
Yeah, 20 people on this crew.
These are your bags you're taking with you?
Yeah, these are our flight bags. They're all weighed. We all have a certain amount of weight we're allowed to carry on the aircraft, and so... Basically, we're allowed to carry 60 pounds. That's with all our personal gear and all our personal protective equipment, hard hats, everything. We got 60 pounds.
What type of gear are you taking?
Actually,
is your bag accessible? Can you show me what's in your bag?
Yeah. In here, I got a sleeping bag, sleeping bag. This is my IA gear, which is actually really stripped down now for weight. I usually got more water bottles, more different stuff in there, but just got the basic essentials right now to take. And here I got all the clothing that I'm bringing, which isn't much. I got maybe 3 or 4 shirts, about 10 pairs of socks, rain gear, because it's supposed to be wet there quite often.
Can I take a picture? Yeah, you might be needing that.
It's supposed to be pretty wet there, so yeah, basically keep your feet dry, and the rest of it, I guess, we'll just deal with as it gets wet.
That's the number one thing, right? Keeping those feet dry.
Yeah, from what I understand, that's a problem with being in the tropical environment, keeping your feet dry. So supposedly they're going to supply us with some good rain boots.
Hopefully some water.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned there's some differences between what you would carry with you normally and what you've got in here. What's the difference?
Well, on a wildfire, I usually have more water. I carry, you know, 8 quarts of water usually because we're going up and out and away from the vehicles. Here we're going to be working on roads where water is probably going to be in the vehicles behind us, so I'm going to carry less water. As far as anything else, I had to take all my batteries out to go on a flight. We usually carry fuel for the saws, which isn't going to be in here because of the flight. I'm going to carry that differently. Pretty much everything that I've changed around has just been for weight, so that I can reduce the amount of weight that I'm carrying so that I can make it on these military aircrafts.
Are the flight restrictions more or less strict than what you have to carry with you when you go out here?
I think they're about the same, as long as, because they do what they're called agency flights, where it's just responders, and we only have for 20 people, we have a 5,300-pound weight limitation.
That's not a lot.
Ourselves and all our personal gear.
Yeah, I was going to say, assuming, because is it all men that are going?
What's that?
Is it all men that are going?
Yeah, our crew is all made up of all men.
Yeah, I mean, let's say the average guy weighs 180, 200 pounds. I mean, you're at 4,000 pounds right there.
That's, yeah, exactly.
You got to travel pretty light.
So only get allowed, you know, whatever amount of personal gear you can carry.
Did you discuss what you were going to take with other guys, or is this kind of just
your own? We've all been kind of bouncing it off each other. The big hang-up's been is if we're going to take tents or not. Our tents weigh almost 10 pounds. I went without it.
Where are you going to sleep?
I have a bivy sack that's a waterproof sleeping bag cover, basically.
So for lack of a better term, you're going to sleep in a plastic bag.
Yeah, exactly. Around my sleeping bag, which I don't expect it to be cold there. It's supposed to be in the 80s most of the time with 80 to 90% humidity, so I don't think staying warm is going to be an issue.
Wife, kids, any of that?
No, I don't have a girlfriend, but I've been spending time with her because I know I'm going to be gone for a while.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, being away from family and stuff like that. I didn't know if you had little ones running around at home or not.
No, I don't, but there's a lot of guys on the crew that are new fathers. And what's that?
What's she thinking? Has she expressed any concern or anything to you?
Yeah, she keeps saying, be careful, and, you know.
And you're like, honey, I jump into the fires like that. How much more dangerous could this be?
Exactly, but, you know, everybody's like, oh, you don't want to catch malaria or anything, you know.
Is that a risk?
No, from what I understand, I've read that there's no malaria in Puerto Rico, but there's other similar diseases, so, yeah, so I don't know. Yeah, it's always a risk.
Anything else you want to add?
Anything you're scared about?
No, I hear the wildlife, there's monkeys and snakes, but the snakes aren't as bad as they are here. So really, I mean, I just look forward to the opportunity to help the people of Puerto Rico, you know, maybe given this opportunity.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Ezra David Romero, filling in for Joe Moore. 60 years ago, taking a road trip in California was a lot different than it is today. In the days before superhighways, hybrid cars, Airbnb, and Uber, a family vacation likely included a stop at a roadside motel. Hundreds of these mom-and-pop establishments popped up in places like Fresno and Bakersfield, offering a clean room, a swimming pool, and maybe even something exotic like a faux Polynesian tiki-themed cocktail lounge. Flashing neon signs and space-age architecture served to draw in customers from the highway. While most of the state's roadside inns have checked out for good, a new book celebrates their glory days. It's called Motel California, and it's by cultural historian Heather David. Valley Edition host and editor Joe Moore caught up with her.
Heather, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Really excited about this new coffee table book that you have. And Fresno plays a big role in your book. In fact, the cover, which is this fabulous vintage photo of the old Tropicana Lodge, which was on Blackstone just south of Ashland, again, makes up the cover. Tell me a little about the Tropicana before we get into talking about these motels in general. What was that place like?
Well, the Tropicana, when it first opened in 1961, was marketed as Central California's finest motel. And it really was spectacular. The Tropicana Lodge was designed by architects Arme and Davis. Some of your listeners may be familiar with Arme and Davis. They're best known as the premier architects of the post-war coffee shop. And so when you think of Arme and Davis, you think of the classic Denny's coffee shop with the boomerang-shaped roofline. They were the architects of the early Bob's Big Boy coffee shops. The Lions coffee shops. Fresno had a nice Lions coffee shop designed by Arme and Davis. So best known as architects of coffee shops, but interestingly enough, they had a pretty broad portfolio, and they designed several motels, oftentimes in conjunction with one of their eye-popping coffee shops. So the Tropicana Lodge not only had a very large motel footprint, it had over 100 rooms, it also had a restaurant, a coffee shop, banquet hall, cocktail lounge, heated pool, and a sauna. And I like to say it was the perfect union of the Jetsons and the Flintstones. you could not miss it driving down Blackstone. It just was, you know, between the signage and the actual building itself, it was roadside advertising at its finest.
So when we talk about motels, what exactly makes a motel a motel? I understand this idea actually came out of Central California in San Luis Obispo.
It did. So this is a real interesting story. So the Motel Inn in San Luis Obispo is thought of as the quote-unquote world's first motel. And it was built in 1925 by developer Arthur Heinemann, and he wanted an inn for traveling motorists going up and down the highway. It was built in Mission Revival style, single story, and it had was typical of motels. They had your room, and then either you could either pull up in your car or you would have an adjoining garage. So the idea of a motel it was that it was more casual than a hotel, where you might have a doorman and you may not even be able to park on the premises. And you could also, be kind of low key. There oftentimes was a restaurant or a coffee shop on site. Obviously, a pool and places where people could socialize, other travelers. And the Motel Inn started off as the Milestone Inn, and they had tried to fit Motor Hotel onto the sign. At least this is the way the story goes. They had to hyphenate it. So instead of Motor Hotel, meaning a hotel geared for the car and the roadside traveler, it became the Mo-Tel. And when you look at early brochures, early motel brochures, you'll notice oftentimes the Mo and the Tel is still hyphenated. And then over time, the hyphen gets lost. There were other motel properties. There were other motor court properties all over the United States. But this was the first time that a motel was actually called a motel.
So what happened? At some point, the motel era came to an end, or at least in large part. There are many that are still out there and functioning, although the prestige that once accompanied these venues is in many cases gone. How did the era begin to come to a close?
Well, what I consider to be kind of the glamorous era of the motel, it started to go into decline, believe it or not, in the early 1960s. So the number of motels peaked in the United States in the early 1960s. It had grown from about, 20,000 or so following World War II up to over 60,000 in the early 1960s. And there were thousands of these motels in the state of California alone. What happened to the motel was, one, market oversaturation, especially in states like California and Florida. Oftentimes, these motels were built aggressively and with the hopes that the market would be there. And there just was, in some cases, there were more motels than potential customers. So the first problem was market oversaturation. The second problem, and this one's a big one, is that the Federal Highway Act of 1956, if you were a small mom and pop and you made the mistake of building your motel along a smaller route that gets bypassed by the interstate highway system, your little property gets neglected. And a lot of the motels and motor hotels and motor inns, as they came to be called in the mid-60s, they were being built right off the highway. And so it pushed a lot of these smaller mom and pops that were on some of the other roads out of business. And the third thing was just the rise of the franchise and referral chains. And there were a number of them in the state of California. Travelodge was based in California. Vagabond was based in California. Motel 6 was based in California. So not only did the mom and pops have to compete with these chains, these local chains, they also had to compete with the national chains like the Holiday Inns and the Ramada.
So in this 200-page coffee table book, you have a number of images from the Fresno area. Tell me about some of your favorites.
Oh, boy. Well, Fresno had a lot. Where to begin? Tropicana Lodge, obviously, is on the cover. I think it's incredible architecture, and the building still exists, at least part of it. The restaurant building was demolished years ago, so obviously I'm a big fan of the Tropicana Lodge and a big fan of the work of Armé and Davis in general. The Manchester Motel is also featured in the book, and it still exists along Blackstone. Again, incredible post-war Googie style or space age architecture. it still has, you know, wonderful roof line, really interesting light fixtures, very 1960s. So it's in the book as well. The Carousel Motel, that was really something special. At one time, Carousel Motel and its adjoining restaurant, it was one of the higher-end restaurants in the area, had two incredible signs designed by Electrical Products Corporation. Now about all that's left is the restaurant building's still there, but boarded up, the last time I saw it at least. And the there is one sole plexiglass pink carousel horse on the property, and that's the only sign that it was once the Carousel Motel. Going on, I would say the Hacienda. I'm fascinated with the Fresno Hacienda because it was the first motel to be built in the chain of Hacienda motels. I think a lot of people think that the Hacienda in Las Vegas was built first, but really the first one to be built was the Fresno Hacienda. And then after that was Vegas, and then Bakersfield, and then Indio. And the Hacienda was best known, of course, for the Mermaid Room Cocktail Lounge, being a venue for big-name show acts, de facto convention center for a while. And they even had like a converted or customized golf cart that used to move around the property, you know, with the background music singing How Dry I Am to get patrons to purchase a cocktail. So the Hacienda's in there as well. Fresno Motel with a spectacular diving lady sign. There's also the Motel El Rancho, the Tradewinds Motor Hotel, which had the world-famous pine cone and branding iron restaurant adjoining. The Yosemite Rancho Motel, again, there's the tie-in to Yosemite. So I think all in all, there are between 9 and 10 motels from Fresno in the book.
How can people get their hands on this new book?
The book is available right now on my website, www.cal, as in California, calmodbooks.com. At some point, it will be in a number of stores up and down the state, but it just came out about 2 weeks back, and so I'm getting it in stores as fast as I can.
We've been talking with Heather David. She is a cultural historian and author of the new book, Motel California, which tells the story of California's roadside inns that were very popular in the mid-century era. And Fresno factors significantly into this new book. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Still to come on Valley Edition, we hear from a UC Merced researcher about her new study on resistance to antibiotics. Plus, we'll learn more about the new conductor with the Fresno Philharmonic.
My first car was a 1985 Mazda GLC, basically a tin can with a very small four-cylinder engine and a four-speed transmission. Popped out a whopping 63 horsepower, topped out at about 55 miles an hour. It was impossible to get any type of speeding ticket in this car, although my sister managed it. I don't know how she did that. By the time I got it, it had about 175,000 miles on it. Each one of my sisters crashed it. I crashed it. I think my mom even crashed it. It kept rolling along. I stuffed an oversized sound system into it to the point where the engine was making a rattling noise, and I decided, you know, it's not anything to worry about it. It's almost got 200,000 miles on it. Just turn up the stereo. By the time I took it in, two of the engine mounts had broken, and the engine was partly resting on the transmission.
Go from tune-up to tune-in. Your car, truck, even that boat that won't float can make great radio. Visit the membership tab at kvpr.org and click on vehicle donation for details.
You're listening to Valley Edition. In this segment, we turn to health. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, bacteria that have become resistant to antibiotics cause around 2 million infections and 23,000 deaths each year in the U.S. alone. Researchers across the globe are working to combat this growing problem, and a team at UC Merced recently published a study contributing some much-needed data to the field. FM89's Carrie Klein is speaking with Miriam Barlow, an evolutionary biologist at UC Merced and the senior author on the study.
Dr. Miriam Barlow, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
So you study antibiotic resistance in bacteria. Can you lay down briefly what are antibiotic resistant bacteria and why is this an important area of research today in the United States?
So antibiotic resistant bacteria are bacteria that just are not killed any longer by antibiotics. And this is important today in the U.S. because so many infections are caused by bacteria, and we have developed a strong reliance on antibiotics as a way of treating these infections, and we're becoming unable to treat infections because of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
And how do bacteria actually become resistant to antibiotics?
So bacteria can become resistant to antibiotics either through mutations that maybe change a target, a drug target inside of the cell. So like the ribosome is responsible for making proteins that are the machines that are running the cell. And a lot of drugs are targeted towards the ribosome, and they just stop protein from being synthesized in the cell. And so if you can mutate the ribosome so that it can still synthesize proteins but not bind to antibiotics any longer, then it has become resistant to those antibiotics.
And some bacteria can become resistant to maybe one or two antibiotics, and some of them actually become resistant to many of them, which can make them more dangerous and more difficult to treat.
Yeah, so at this point, gonorrhea, there are strains of gonorrhea that are resistant to all the antibiotics that are available, and the same is true for tuberculosis. There are others that are resistant to many, but maybe not everything yet.
So how did you get interested in this line of research to begin with?
Once upon a time, I wanted to go to medical school, and then I decided I didn't want to do that, and I wanted to be an evolutionary biologist instead, but I still had an interest in medicine and human health. And then I just kind of randomly found an advisor who was doing experimental evolution but wanted to move in a direction of antibiotic resistance, and so we did, and then I was just kind of hooked on it since then.
And so in your career, you've really studied a lot of facets of this issue, from safe antibiotic treatment strategies to the genetics of antibiotic resistance to processes that may actually reverse antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, this is true.
And your latest paper, though, which you published just a few weeks ago, it sounds a bit wonkier. It deals specifically with a software and data platform, but you also told me you think it might be your coolest paper you've published yet. What makes it so neat?
Well, so we've been involved in developing a new assay for measuring fitness. So fitness has typically been really difficult to measure in the lab. It's really labor-intensive, the methods that have been historically used.
That's the fitness of bacteria themselves, right?
Yes, that's the fitness of bacteria. It is how well they survive and how well they reproduce. And so we have been using a different assay that's a lot higher throughput, a lot easier to run, and that enables us to measure the fitness of hundreds of bacteria, hundreds of different strains of bacteria at one time instead of just maybe 8 or 10. This has been done historically. And so we've been doing this, and it's a really sensitive method, and there's variance in the measurements of the samples. So we've come up with a statistical package and a program that can tell us how important that variance is. And so it's taking this method that's a really powerful method, but then giving us greater statistical power to use it and to interpret biology based on our findings.
And along with this, you know, this methodology, you also mm-hmm. published an enormous actual, you know, source of data as well, enormous store of data.
Mm-hmm. So fitness data, because they have traditionally been so hard to generate, are highly valued by the evolutionary biology community, and especially people who study population genetics and adaptive landscapes, which is a way of comparing fitness of different strains and predicting how they're going to evolve. So in generating these statistics, we had to measure about 52,000 independent assays, and people are interested in just the raw data of these reads so that they can generate their own studies from these data. And so we've released this enormous data set, and we're happy for people to use it in any way they see fit.
And then a year ago, you published another study about where antibiotic resistance actually evolves. And that involves some participation of Mercy Medical Center, a hospital in Merced. Tell me about what you found there.
So Mercy has been a great collaborator to work with, and they have been providing us with resistant strains from their hospital and the accompanying antibiograms that go with them. So they provided all of their testing for resistance that has occurred in the hospital. And so we just, in looking at the testing that Mercy Medical Center has done for resistance in these isolates, we were able to ask the question, is antibiotic resistance evolving in the hospital? And the idea of this is that if antibiotic resistance is evolving in a hospital type setting, there should be non-random patterns of resistance that are occurring there. Strains should be related to each other, and resistance should be non-random. And so we looked, and we found that for 12 of 15 antibiotics, it seemed like the patterns were totally random. And then there were three where there was some non-randomness going on in the hospital, but it actually seems like resistance was improving in two of the three cases in the hospital, which speaks very well of Mercy Medical Center. So for most antibiotic resistance, it's probably coming into the hospital from outside. And so then that leads to the question of where is antibiotic resistance actually evolving?
Right. And what are, and I understand this is ongoing research, so you don't actually have conclusions yet. What are some options or some hypotheses that you're studying related to that?
So two of the options that are available is that resistance is primarily influenced by outpatient treatment. So when you go to the family doctor and they prescribe an antibiotic, that is one source of antibiotics outside of hospitals. Another one that's actually a much larger one is selection in agriculture. So, and I'm doing this work in collaboration with Mark Sistrom. He's a bioinformaticist. But in agriculture, so many antibiotics are given to animals just in feed to keep them healthy, to promote their growth. And there is just a very large amount of antibiotics being dumped into the environment. And so that seems like a very likely source as a primary source for antibiotic resistance evolving. And so we're starting to investigate how resistant things are out in the environment outside of the hospital.
That sounds really exciting.
Thank you.
And any other long-term projects that are on your plate?
We are also trying to find ways of reversing the evolution of antibiotic resistance that can be used in a hospital or maybe outside in the larger community if different parties are willing to coordinate. And so we've kind of shown in the lab that we can reverse evolution if we have known resistance genes and we know exactly what's going on. We can come up with these probabilistic measures of how likely we are to reverse antibiotic resistance if we use certain drugs in a certain sequence. But it really varies depending on what antibiotic resistance genes are present. And so what we want to do is measure, using our new fitness assays and the improved statistics for them, we want to measure the fitness of many different strains with many different resistance genotypes and come up with these probabilistic ways of optimizing the use of antibiotics and then look for overlap between them. And hopefully we find patterns of antibiotic consumption that decrease resistance for many different antibiotic resistance genes.
Great. Well, it sounds really interesting. Dr. Miriam Barlow, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking with you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Ezra David Romero, filling in for Joe Moore. It's a new era for the Fresno Philharmonic as Ray Hotoda, the new music director and conductor of the orchestra, is set to lead the orchestra in her first concert coming up Sunday, October 15th at the Soroyan Theater. Valley Edition host and editor Joe Moore caught up with her about what to expect.
Ray, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you back. We talked to you when you were a candidate for this job and also talked to you once you first were awarded this position. Now it's becoming real. This is your first full-time conductor's gig with this orchestra. How excited are you as this concert is approaching?
I am so thrilled and really excited to share this opening concert with everyone here in Fresno. Invitation to all to come and hear me conduct this fantastic orchestra, a gem in this community.
What do you do to prepare for something like this? Not just the regular concert preparation. There's a lot that has gone up to leading to this day on Sunday. Tell me a little about how this is different.
Well, being a music director, I have to actually stop myself and pinch myself sometimes to say, oh, I'm the conductor. I am the music director of your Fresno Philharmonic, instead of saying, oh, I'm the assistant conductor of the Utah Symphony or, you know, something like that, where I've had associate and assistant positions with other major orchestras. This now is my orchestra, and I feel that not only the preparation, but the mindset for me is so different, and the approach is so completely new to me that I am so excited and pumped for this first inaugural season.
So I want to talk about this concert now, and it's a very appropriate first piece that you have for the orchestra, a piece that was commissioned by the New York Philharmonic for its 150th anniversary. It's called New Era Dance. I take it there's some intentional symbolism here.
Yes, it was written in 2000 for the New York Philharmonic. Their new music director at that time was Lauren Mazel. And this piece really symbolizes the political and social change that they were, you know, hoping to have in the turn of the millennium, and how appropriate even now. So this piece is not only symbolic of political and social change, but also sonically and musically, it's incorporating a lot of jazz elements. You will hear towards the end something surprising, which is that the orchestra speaks in this piece. And that's something a little bit different. But it's celebratory in nature, and it's very driving and rhythmic and not percussive, but more dance-like. You know, it's got this extremely exciting energy, which I wanted to bring immediately to the forefront of this concert.
Now, looking at the concert selections that you have set for this Masterworks concert season, almost all of the concerts have either a work from a living composer or a composer from the 20th century. Tell me about your philosophy in trying to introduce maybe new works to audiences when we're trying to reach out to new people. Sometimes 20th century or even 21st century classical music has a reputation of being somewhat challenging. How do you try to navigate that balance there of presenting something familiar and also something fresh?
Well, music is accessible to everyone. That's what I'm thinking. And with the music of our century, of the 21st century, I want it to be something where they can connect the stories behind the piece to the masterworks of the orchestral repertoire. You know, there is a story underlying these wonderful new works that people can relate to, and I'm choosing and specifically picking pieces that really relate to the other pieces, the canons of the orchestral repertoire. Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4, Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 will have something new with that program. And how does that tie together? And this is the story that I want to try and share with everyone in the audience, that these works, they might be from different centuries, but they do have the same intense story to share with us. And how that unfolds is really up to the listener. You know, curiosity is the forefront of people's minds when they come to our concerts. What does that mean? Oh, a living woman composer? Wow, what does that sound like? You know, let's go on this discovery together.
Again, Ray Hotota, the new music director and conductor of the Fresno Philharmonic, joins us today. We're talking about her first concert as a leader of the orchestra. You are also a pianist in your musical career. Tell me what the Grieg Piano Concerto means to you. This is also on the bill on Sunday.
That's right. It's an incredible virtuosic work. And Natasha Perinsky is our soloist. I'm so excited and thrilled to work with her. I've never worked with her before, so this will be an exciting week. And I have to say, this is a rock-solid piece that's in the piano repertoire. Everyone learns it, and I've never played it. So the other day, I sat down, you know, to do a couple of cadenzas and things that I want to make sure that I catch with her this weekend. And I'm sitting at the piano, kind of fiddling around with the notes, and I'm amazed, just the opening, you know, this incredible timpani roll, and then all of a sudden the pianist comes in with this, with these major and minor chords, and I'm just thinking, how can these chords just cascading down the whole keyboard have such an impact? And it does. And it's just a brilliantly virtuosic work, one that people will recognize, first of all, but also that really showcases the soloist.
Do you go into a piece looking for those particular parts of a work that you want to offer something maybe different or a different interpretation? Do you strategically go into open a score and say, what in here can I put my stamp on, or is a different approach? How does that work?
Absolutely. For instance, the final piece on this program is the Respighi's Pines of Rome, and the second movement is the Catacombs, Pines near the Catacombs. And I've heard it a million times. I've conducted it, and I wanted to kind of bring a new light to it. And so I was sitting down at the piano. And it's difficult, you know, to realize scores on the piano. But luckily, being a pianist, I have a little bit, of arsenal to pull out to read these scores. And I'm just amazed. I'm always amazed when you break it down and I'm playing the harmonies and I'm playing through it, that the simplicity of it, but also the complexity. And so to be enlightened every time I look at a score that I've done before, it's eye-opening for me, and it's exciting for me. And so then I think, okay, well, how can I do that a little bit differently? Oh, I know, I can do this. You know, I can sustain this sound more than this, voice this chord with a second trombone instead of, you know, bringing out the flute solo. Those kinds of things are really interesting and fascinating to me. It's like, it's a little geeky, I know, and nerdy, but I like finding those little things that make a difference.
Do conductors have problems they have to deal with and are in search of a solution? In so many jobs that we have, we're tasked with taking on a challenge aside from generating new audience and keeping the orchestra strong and serving its community. In that sense, do you sometimes approach a work and, you know, your husband's also a conductor.
That's right.
A sort of a conductor talk at the kitchen table or the dinner table about, you know, how should I do this? Or maybe
always.
He goes to you and asks the same thing.
Always. And it's always in the middle of, like, when our kids are running around and we're trying to cook dinner and we're trying to get everyone, you know, to the table. Oh, how would you do this movement? Would you do it in three or one? Can we talk about it later? You know, it's always at the wrong time in our household. But yes, we do talk shop all the time, and we talk about repertoire. Would you take this repeat, or would you not take this repeat in Beethoven 5? So it's exciting to live with a conductor. The scheduling is horrendous, but other than that, it's exciting to share ideas in that way.
Speaking of scheduling, will your family be here for this concert to see your debut?
Yes, my mother is coming from Chicago, and my son will be here for this concert.
That has to be a very special moment for you. Now you aren't going to be a full-time Fresno resident. What is the challenge of just of schedules been like for you and your family trying to make everything work?
Well, I feel like I'll be a partial residence here. I want to make sure that I have a foothold in this community, and know that I'm a part of this community is very important to me. You know, it just makes sense right now, to because my family's in Illinois, my son's a senior in high school, to have him finish up one more year. It's scheduling is always a challenge to really make sure that I have everything that I need done during the weeks that I'm here. But I love that. I love getting out there, getting to know the community, getting to know different people in the community, and seeing what impact the Fresno Philharmonic can make in this community.
So this concert coming up Sunday is really a showcase for the different sounds an orchestra can create. Looking at this concert, you go from the new piece, New Era Dance, by Aaron J. Kernis, to Edvard Grieg, and then Claude Debussy, and Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. A very different piece, but tell me why this is on the schedule.
Sure.
And how it maybe relates to the others.
Yes. So the second half of the program really resonates with the nature surrounding Fresno. And I was thinking, you know, the Pines of Rome, the majestic mountains that we're surrounded by, with Yosemite, you know, about 2 hours away, and just the sheer beauty of this area. I was thinking Afternoon of a Faun would be a beautiful way to have nature represented. It is evocative piece and one that features the flute. So I'm very excited to feature, you know, individual members of the orchestra, this fine orchestra. But and then in relation to the Pines of Rome, you know, again, being a nature-oriented second half, The Afternoon of a Faun is evocative in that it was Nijinsky who did the ballet, the dance to it with Debussy, Claude Debussy, and it's by a poem by Stéphanie Mallarmé, a French poet. And it was premiered and written 1 year before the Rite of Spring. You know, so there is all this experimental language being used by the composers, and the dance reflected that as well. And I was fortunate enough to see the ballet done live and with the music, and it's just so, even now, it's riveting and provocative. And so I thought it'd be a nice contrast to the first half, but also kind of sets up the tone for the Respighi Pines of Rome.
And let's go on to that, a very different piece again, a huge sound from the orchestra on this famous work. Is it challenging for the orchestra or for an orchestra to go from all of these different sounds and styles in one concert? And tell me how Pines of Rome fits in here sonically.
Sure. Yes, it is challenging for the orchestra to go from something more intimate like the Debussy to something grandiose and majestic, like the Pines of Rome, only in that, you know, they just have to switch gears, and they're incredible musicians, so I don't have any issues or worries about them being able to do that. But it is a different mindset, and that's my job on the podium, is to really bring that to my work in, you know, working through the rehearsals and making this happen. But what's interesting about what we're doing with this piece is we're inviting members of the brass students from the Fresno State University to join us in this piece. And so at the very end, we will have 17 brass players playing the finale at the end, the march to Appia. So again, I'm trying to bring in the community and bring in the wonderful cultural diversity that we have here and give them an opportunity to perform with us.
You've been meeting with a lot of community groups, supporters, other people in the Fresno area as part of your job, because it's not just leading the orchestra on the podium, but also in the community and being a cultural symbol for Fresno. What have you learned? What has that experience been like, getting to know people now that you actually have the job and not auditioning in that sense?
Well, first of all, it's a warm and welcoming community. I am just so touched by people reaching out and people just embracing me into this community when I feel that immediately here. And I just so appreciate this incredible city, you know, to embrace me like this. It's really touching. And I don't want to disappoint, you know, so I want to continue this conversations that we're having, and I want to really do something and make a difference here.
Any favorite things that you've gotten to do so far in your time that you have been here, experiences or places you've been, a particularly good meal or anything
yes.
like that?
Yes. Well, first of all, I love to eat, and I love the diversity of the restaurants we have here. The ethnic restaurants are fabulous. So I'm really eager to explore even more of that. And so I'll have to work out more. But anyway, and also I'm from the Midwest, and I am always surprised how amazing the produce is here, and just trying the different fruits and vegetables that are grown in this area. I'm so delighted.
And we are so delighted to have you here in our community and celebrating this new era with the Fresno Philharmonic. Ray Hatoda, the new music director and conductor of the orchestra, leading the Fresno Phil in her first concert as its leader on Sunday, October 15th, 3 p.m. at the Soroyan Theater, featuring music by Edvard Grieg, Claude Debussy, Respighi, and the new piece by Aaron J. Kernis that is coming up again on Sunday. Ray, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. Thanks to our reporting team, Carrie Klein, Jeffrey Hess, and Laura Sutsui. Audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and filling in for Valley Edition host Joe Moore, I'm reporter-producer Ezra David Romero. Have a great day.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, with a new partnership. Find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.